So it's my pleasure then to ask Stephen Snowden to come forward and speak to us concerning the Bible, the King James translation.
Thank you, Brother Mac. It's a delight to be back in my hometown amongst friends and family, and also a delight to speak on this subject. I want to do several things this evening. I'm working on two projects on the English Bible. Started out as one project, now it's become two. One is to provide a history of the English Bible with a focus on the King James. Of course, we've had the 400th anniversary last year, and this has caused a lot of people to reflect on the significance of the King James Bible, the significance of the King James Bible in our culture and also in religion. The second project is to look at words, phrases, and idioms that have come from the Bible and also the English Bible and have entered into secular language. And I'm going to refer to that shortly. What I've done is we have some sort of show-and-tell items here at the front, and I'll just, explain those right now. There are three binders that look like this that contain lists of words, phrases, and idioms that come from the Bible that are now used in English, and also three other binders, this one and the two large ones over there, that have leaves, authentic leaves from historic Bibles. So, and I'll show you some slides from those. So after the lecture, I'm hoping that you'll come up and take a look at some of these. We have a couple authentic Bibles from the era of the King James, including a 1611 Geneva. And we have this mighty Bible right here, which is a full-size facsimile of the King James. It's 30 pounds, weighs 30 pounds. So it's the same size and weight as the original. And the reason why we have this on display is that you can talk about what the Bible looked like. You can talk about its physical dimensions, but there's nothing, you can't replace actually seeing it and indeed trying to lift it. It's quite big, and it makes a bit of a thump when you put it down. It's very much a pulpit Bible. It's very much an establishment Bible. And when you look at it, when you open it up, it's very dignified, and it was meant to convey the authority of the church, as well as, of course, bring the Bible to the people in English. So please do take a look at those items afterwards. Okay, you're looking at the frontispiece to the original King James. One other thing to mention before I begin to go through the material is, as the presider noted, there are two handouts. One of them, the one that just has printing on one side, is a list of rules that the companies of translators who produced the King James Bible adhered to. And it makes interesting reading. The other list, which is printed on both sides, provides an overview of the English Bible from its earliest days back in the medieval period through to the King James Bible itself. So it goes into a little more detail than I will in our presentation this evening. Okay, now, when we start to think about works that have helped shape the English language, sorry, I just want to have it on my laptop screen as well. I can either have it on my laptop or here. Okay, well, I'm going to have to read from the screen then. Okay, so here are some works that have influenced the English language. Obviously, Shakespeare, Samuel Johnson's dictionary, which not only helped shape the English language, but helped standardize English spelling. It wasn't really standardized until that point. The OED, the Oxford English Dictionary, and of course, the English Bible in the form of the King James Version of 1611. And that is what we're going to be talking about mostly this evening. We will focus on several aspects of the influence of the Bible. Religion, of course, is the big one, but the King James Bible has influenced culture and law and morality, Ten Commandments, etc., politics, and also science. And actually, that relates to my day job as a historian of science. It's now well known that in the early modern period, biblical ideas help shape and even generate science in the 16th, 17th, and 18th centuries. So this is an important thing that not a lot of people know about, but it's certainly well known within history of science. Now, what you're looking at here is the Canadian coat of arms. And there are two biblical mottos on the Canadian coat of arms, A Mari Usque Ad Marem, from sea to sea. That's from Psalm 72 and verse 8. May he have dominion from sea to sea and from the river to the ends of the earth. So there's one phrase from the Bible using the Latin. And then the other one, which is a little harder to see, it's right there in the center, is Desiderantes meliorum patrium. They desire a better country. And that is from Hebrews chapter 11 and verse 16. So the Canadian coat of arms has two biblical mottos. And this is just one example of the ways in which the language of the Bible has infiltrated culture, politics, and also everyday life. So here's a list of some biblical terms that have come into English. Am I my brother's keeper? To put words in one's mouth, the apple of his eye, fall down flat, play the fool from time to time, broken heart, to everything there is a season, turn the world upside down. The straight and narrow, beside himself, count the cost, the powers that be, all in all, suffer fools gladly, labor of love, the love of money is the root of all evil, wallow in the mire, bottomless pit. Now you'll see many more of these kinds of phrases in the binders that I've already referred to on the table at the front. Now there's a wonderful YouTube clip that shows an Anglican clergyman from Scotland reading 100 phrases from the King James Bible in 3 minutes. Well, I'm going to try to do 400 in just over six. This will give you a sense of how many phrases come from the English Bible and have entered our English language. Okay. In the beginning, one day, one of these days, one and the same, two are better than one, once and for all things to all men, all in all things must pass. 11th hour, time of need, the time is short, signs of the times, from time to time, a time for everything, to everything there is a season. Dearly beloved, first love, labor of love, loving kindness, love thy neighbor, your love is better than wine, the love of money is the root of all evil. Fall short, fall down flat, fall flat on his face, fall on his sword, fall by the wayside, fall from grace, divided we fall, pride before a fall, crumbs fall from the table, stars fall from the sky, scales fall from eyes. How are the mighty fallen? Play the fool, play the man, play the madman, beside himself in his right mind, no small stir, no respecter of persons, no room in the inn, no man can serve two masters, nothing new under the sun, fret not. The half was not told me. Do not let your left hand know what your right hand is doing. Strength to strength, face to face, sea to sea, eye to eye. Eye for an eye, eye of a needle. An evil eye, eye service, wise in his own eyes. Apple of his eye, twinkling of an eye, seeing is believing. A gift blinds the wise. The blind leading the blind. Look one another in the face. Say it to his face. His face fell. Over my head, head on a platter. Heap coals of fire on his head. Stiff-necked, risking one's neck. Millstone around the neck. Hair standing on end. Hair breadth. Tingling ears. Itching ears. Turn the other cheek. Honey lips. Skin of one's teeth. Teeth set on edge. Weeping and gnashing of teeth. A heavy hand. Feet of clay. Lick the dust. Shake the dust from your feet. Stand in awe. Broken heart. Broken-hearted. Break my heart. Hard-hearted. Heavy heart, cut to the heart, pour out one's heart, a man after his own heart, set one's heart on something, their hearts melted, heart's desire, heart of stone, stone's throw, him, he that is without sin, let him cast the first stone. Sowing discord, 100. Reap what you sow, reap the whirlwind, scatter to the wind, inherit the wind, day by day, daily bread, your days are numbered, sufficient unto the day is the evil thereof. Let there be light, I saw the light, lesser light, shining light. Let your light shine. Hide a light under a bushel. Make light of something. Through a glass darkly, out of darkness into light, cast into outer darkness. Land of Nod, land of the living, land flowing with milk and honey, promised land, fat of the land, spy out the land, stranger in a strange land, salt of the earth, scum of the earth, face of the earth, ends of the earth, four corners of the earth, new heavens and new earth, man of the world without end, turn the world upside down. Fly in the ointment, strain at a gnat, wise as serpents, harmless as doves, dove with olive leaf. A little bird told me, lost sheep, a lamb to the slaughter. Separate the sheep from the goats. A wolf, the wolf shall dwell with the lamb, as sheep in the midst of wolves, wolves in sheep's clothing. A lion's den, golden calf, kill the fatted calf. Can a leopard change its spots? Don't cast its pearls before swine. The four horsemen of the apocalypse. Ivory tower, tower of Babel, tower of strength, den of thieves. Set your house in order, house divided. House built on sand, bricks without straw, shelter from the storm, streets paved with gold, go the extra mile, road to Damascus, walking on water, change your ways, parting of the ways, drive like Jehu, wheels within wheels, white as snow, whited sepulchres, gird up thy loins, take up the mantle, bear fruit, take root, root of the matter, drop in a bucket, O ye of little faith, more and more, many are called, but few are chosen. To whom much is given, much is expected. Coat of many colors, many mansions. Weighed in the balances, count the cost. Your days are numbered. 70. Old as the hills, old as Methuselah. Before the flood, the powers that be, high places, higher powers from on high. Deep waters, bottomless pit. A Job's comforter, the patience of Job. The wisdom of Solomon, the good Samaritan. 200. Doubting Thomas, it is written, writing on the wall. Let thy words be few, eat your words. Put words in one's mouth, the word made flesh, in the spirit, not the letter, letter of the law, holding forth, out of the mouth of babes, shout from the rooftops, a voice crying in the wilderness, still, small voice, sweating blood, blood crying from the ground, blood on one's hands, blood money, 30 pieces of silver, render unto Caesar, filthy lucre, crown of thorns, thorn in the side, thorn in the flesh, no for a certainty, no in the biblical sense, raising Cain, am I my brother's keeper? Prodigal son, like mother, like daughter, old wives' fables, the sins of the fathers, next of kin, battering ram, fight the good fight, beating the air, kick against the pricks, beard a lion in his own den, live by the sword, perish by the sword. The race is not to the swift, nor the battle to the strong. Beat swords into plowshares, no peace for the wicked, peace offering. It came to pass, laugh to scorn, put to shame, fuel to the fire. Make haste, lay waste, suffer fools gladly, suffer the children, eat, drink, and be merry. Cast thy bread upon the waters, bread of affliction, breaking bread, butter up, sour grapes. By their fruits ye shall know them, forbidden fruit, fig leaf, new wine in old bottles, turning water into wine, my cup runneth over. Born again, wishing one had never been born, be fruitful and multiply, cradle to the grave. You can't take it with you, give up the ghost, go the way of all flesh, the quick and the dead. Left half dead, dead to the world at death's door, angel of death, sick unto death, kiss of death, though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death, meet your maker, breath of life, tree of life, book of life, choose life, good name, good news, good for nothing, good conscience, crystal clear, holier than thou, be horribly afraid, in all his glory, make a spectacle of oneself, wallow in the mire, baptism by fire, trial by fire, rise and shine, time and chance, root and branch, jot and tittle, 300. Straight and narrow, safe and sound, flesh and blood, fire and brimstone, Adam and Eve, David and Goliath, Samson and Delilah, straight and narrow, Alpha and Omega, angel, apocalypse, apostle, ark, Armageddon, atonement, astrologer, astronomer, atonement, Babel, backslide, bedlam, behemoth, birthday, birthright, blab, bloodthirsty, botch, busybody, castaway, cherub, childbearing, childishness, daytime, devil, dirge, disciple, doctrine, doomsday, Eden, epiphany, excellent, exodus, finisher, fisherman, fleshpots, godliness, godspeed, gospel, intercession, Jeremiad, Jeroboam, Jezebel, Jubilee, Judas, Leviathan, liberty, liquid, long-suffering, loving-kindness, mammon, manna, maudlin, Messiah, Methuselah, needlework, network, Nimrod, paradise, peacemaker, persuasion, plague, resurrection, rose-colored, Satan, scapegoat, seashore, seer, seraph, shibboleth, sin, sinner, sorcerer, stargazer, stumbling block, talent, taskmaster, two-edged, uproar, viper, wine-bibber, wordy, zealous. Woe is me, I'm at my wit's end. Much study is a weariness of the flesh. Of making many books, there is no end. All good things come to an end. The end of the matter. Hallelujah. Amen. That's 400 phrases that have come from the English Bible, and in particular, the King James. And that's not all of them. There's probably twice as many as that. So that gives you a sense of how influential the Bible has been. And we know why it has been, because for many centuries, it was the book. It was the one book that most people had in the home. Now, we're losing that. The Bible is in retreat in our culture, but the effects of its earlier history are still very much felt. I want to put it to you that a very common word that we use in English, internet, has biblical roots because it can be traced back to a coinage of William Tyndale, network. And that's where we get, ultimately, the word internet from. The most common phrase that comes from the King James is from time to time. And this can be tracked statistically. We can trace it back to the 16th century. Now that I know that it's from the Bible, I see it all the time. It's marking exams of some students wrote an exam for me a couple weeks ago, and I saw it in three exam essays from time to time. It's a very, very common phrase. And again, that's probably the most common. So in the cover story of the December 2011 National Geographic magazine, there was a chart that was produced showing, I think it was 18 different phrases that come from the King James, and they displayed their sizes depending on how frequent their use is in English. And from time to time is used so often that they couldn't put it on the fold-out sheet. Instead, they showed it in front of Westminster Abbey because the F in from time to time would be 35 feet high. So a hugely common expression that comes from comes through the King James. And indeed, the Hebrew really does mean from time to time. And we see this in the Greek and also the Latin. Here's one, reap what you sow, in an article about seed companies. Right? So that's from the Bible as well. We see biblical language in science. This is an area of my own research. Cainism, fratricide, and eagle hatchlings, Noah's ark shell, the Ark of Noah, the burning bush shrub, the Goliath beetle, probably heard of that, Solomon's seal, St. John's wort, the Jesus lizard, which actually can walk or run on water. It's quite a thing to see. The crown of thorns starfish, there you see it right there, so you can see why it's called that. In biology and genetics, mitochondrial Eve, these are often just metaphors. You see the tree of life, Darwin uses that. The Methuselah gene, Methuselah is used quite a bit for longevity, for obvious reasons, Methuselah being the longest lived man in the Bible. In environmentalism, the Eden Project, the Frozen Ark, the Alliance to Rescue Civilization, the Archive, A-R-K, Genesis Probe, Methuselah Planet. This is from a book produced by Archive, and you can see the logo has Noah's Ark on it. And Sir David Attenborough is an atheist, so he's not trying to promote the Bible, but he's using this metaphor, which is so prominent in our society. I really like this one where you see a zebra in front of a barcode. 20th century art, taking stock of nature's riches. So another biblical allusion from the science context. In man's image, in the image of God. This is also an allusion to Michelangelo's painting in the Sistine Chapel, which actually does not very well depict how the Bible describes Adam being created, because obviously God breathed into his nostrils the breath of life. But nevertheless, the in man's image is an allusion to the Bible. There you see the an image depicting Adam and Eve for the anniversary of the discovery of the double helix of DNA. Tree of Life and science book, Book of Life, Stephen Jay Gould. So very common in science, and this is perhaps unexpected because a lot of people feel that science and religion don't have a lot to do with each other. One of the great things about the anniversary, I just want to reflect on this now, is that a large number of really good works were published. Even before the anniversary, Alistair McGrath's In the Beginning, and also Brenson Broderick's Wide as the Waters, the title has an allusion to the Bible, and Adam Nicholson's God's Secretaries. I think that is out in the foyer. And this one as well, Gordon Campbell's Bible, Story of the King James Version. And this one traces idioms that come from the King James Bible. Derek Wilson's The Remarkable History of the King James Version, the People's Bible. Melvin Bragg, Lord Bragg, as he's called in England, the Book of Books, the radical impact of the King James Bible, arguing that the King James Bible had an impact in society and politics and law, etc. And David Norton's History of the King James Bible, see the title page there. Leland Ryken, who is a literary scholar as well as a biblical scholar, celebrating 400 years of the most influential English translation. This one produced by the British and Foreign Bible Society, famous phrases from the Bible, listing 300 phrases from the Bible, including many from the King James Bible. And one of the things that was interesting about last year's anniversary is that many non-believers celebrated the King James Bible as well, including the now late Christopher Hitchens, who of course is a vociferous atheist. And he published an article called When the King Saved God, praising the King James, but more than that, praising William Tyndale, arguing, for example, that Tyndale made correct translation choices when he, for example, translated Ecclesiae in the New Testament as congregation rather than church. So the High Church Anglicans wanted it translated as church, but Tyndale translated Ecclesiae as congregation, and that's a much better translation because Ecclesiae does refer to the people, not to a building. So even atheists celebrating the King James Bible, and of all magazines, the National Geographic, as already mentioned, December 2001. There was also a number of exhibitions, one at the University of Toronto, and this one was at the Bodleian Library in Oxford. A commemorative £2 coin was produced that has the first words of the King James Bible in the beginning was the word. So that is something else that was produced for the anniversary. And in the lead up to the anniversary, what is quite clearly the definitive edition of the King James Bible produced by David Norton, and it's mentioned at the end of the handout, The English Bible, Important Medieval and Early Modern Translations. So this is as close as we'll get to the original intentions of the King James translators. And you can buy a paperback version of it for about $15, the Penguin Classics edition. And so the text is set, when it's prose, it's set in paragraphs, and when it's poetry, it's set in verse. So it makes it a lot easier to read. And all the spelling has been updated. Also, the Bible Society produced a special edition of the King James with a foreword by His Royal Highness, the Prince of Wales. So everyone was getting into it, and it was good, I think, because it raised awareness of the King James Bible, but also the Bible in general, and its influence in society. Now, I want to go back a little bit in time and just say something about a Welsh girl, 16-year-old Welsh girl named Mary Jones. And I know we have a Jones in the audience tonight. Not sure if he's a relation of Mary Jones, but Mary Jones was a very poor girl living in an obscure Welsh village. And at the age of 16, she walked 25 miles across the Welsh countryside to obtain a Bible in the Welsh language. And this feat and her dedication was the inspiration for the British and Foreign Bible Society, which was founded in 1804 and still exists to this day. The story speaks to the desire to have a personal Bible. She didn't have a personal Bible. There was no family Bible in the home. But it also says something about a culture of books that is gradually, if not rapidly, retreating. And 16-year-old girls and boys today, of course, carry around smartphones and connect through social media. It's quite a different world. And I teach young people who are a little bit older than that, and I have to ban electronic devices in the classroom because they're doing this all the time, and it's really frustrating. Technology should be a servant. We shouldn't be servants to it. So this is a simpler time that we see exemplified in the life of this young girl. And so this book was produced in the late Victorian period to commemorate her desire to have a Bible in her own language. So I think it's worth just going back and reflecting on the simplicity of this period just over 200 years ago. Now we can access the Bible in many different ways. There are many different translations available. The Bible is affordable. You can access it online. You can have it on your personal device. It's everywhere, and yet it's not read as much as it used to be. So there's an interesting paradox to think about there. So Mary Jones, the story of Mary Jones. Also, in the Victorian period, it was very common for every home to have at least one book, and that was the English Bible. And here we see an engraving from the year 1835. So it's kind of a Jane Austen sort of scene, where you see the head of the family reading from the Bible. The Bible was read. It was read in the home. It was read in the church. Everyone knew the Bible, and there was only one translation, the King James translation. And the benefit of this, of course, is that everyone heard the word in exactly the same way. Whether or not the translation was always correct, everyone heard the language in exactly the same way. So it was actually a lot easier to memorize the Bible. Today it's much more difficult, partly because we don't memorize things like we used to, because we have everything at our fingertips. We're lazy now. Our brains are still the same. We're a little bit lazier. But also, when you're hearing the Word of God in exactly the same translation, it's a lot easier. Everyone's using the same translation. So you can say, where's that verse that goes da-da-da-da? And now we say, where's that verse that goes something like this? Because we've heard it in so many different translations. So you can arguably get too much of a good thing. Now, something that we must not forget about the Bible. We could talk about modern translations. We can access the Bible electronically in various formats. But we mustn't forget that it's an ancient text. And this is a very important issue when it comes to translation, respecting the fact that the Bible is an ancient text. It uses ancient metaphors. And good translations don't paper over those. They let those metaphors come through with all their vividness and freshness. So the Bible that we have is based on ancient scrolls, like the Isaiah scroll we see here from the Dead Sea Scroll collection, and also New Testament manuscripts and fragments. This is possibly the oldest fragment, although a group of manuscripts is now about to be published next year that may mean that this is now not the oldest New Testament fragment. But this is the John Rylands fragment. It's a piece of John 18, and it dates to between 100 and 125 A.D., so within a generation of the writing of the Gospel of John. So we have very good witnesses to these ancient texts. And then after that, we see a series of ancient versions. They're usually called versions, translations. The first of those being the Greek translation of the Old Testament, which starts in 250 B.C. So that's the first translation of the Bible. Then we see the Syriac, the Coptic, the Old Latin, and the Vulgate. The Vulgate was the Bible in Europe for about 1,000 years. It's actually a reasonably good translation. It's a reasonably literal translation, quite faithful to the original. The problem with the Vulgate is that gradually people lost the ability to read it, and only educated people could read it because the Latin language evolved into various Romance languages, and then in the German, in the north of Europe, Germanic languages were spoken. But it is a good translation. It's just not a good translation if you don't know Latin. A number of alphabets were actually invented for the express purpose of bringing the Bible to various people. So the Gothic alphabet, the Armenian alphabet, the Georgian alphabet, the Albanian alphabet, and most famously the Cyrillic alphabet, which is used for Russian, etc. These were invented largely to bring the Bible to those peoples. Now, English Bible translation dates to the Middle Ages. And what you're seeing here is an engraving of Holy Island, or Lindisfarne, Lindisfarne Abbey ruins here. And it's a tidal island. It's quite an interesting place to visit. My family and I visited in the late 90s. And there was a Latin version of the Gospels, a very ornate version. It's now called the Lindisfarne Gospels, held at the British Library. You see the Latin. It's very, very ornate. A lot of care went into producing this text. And then there's an Anglo-Saxon gloss. Anglo-Saxon is Old English. So this is one of the earliest English translations. This is the Kells, the Book of Kells, which is a gospel that is now held at Trinity College, Dublin. This is what is called the Biblia Pauperum, the Bible of the poor. So for people who were illiterate, they produced a Bible that had text, but also pictures. And it functioned in a very similar way to stained glass windows. They're meant for the illiterate, and there were many illiterate people in Europe at that time. I should point out that within Jewish culture, 100% of males in the Middle Ages could read, but that was not at all the case in the Christian context. So you fast forward to the time of John Wycliffe. There's a facsimile of Wycliffe's New Testament on the table at the front. Wycliffe was a reformer. He opposed certain traditional teachings of the Roman Catholic Church, such as transubstantiation. He opposed various corruptions of the church. He was also an advocate of Bible translation in the vernacular. And although he didn't translate the Bible that bears his name, which is why it's often called the Wycliffeite Bible, he was certainly the chief inspiration. And he may have taken a part early on in its translation. There are two versions of it, an earlier version, which is quite literal, kind of slavishly depends on the Latin, and a later one, which is more idiomatic and actually is has much more natural English. Now, I've referred just briefly to the fact that this is a translation from the Latin, right? So it's a translation of a translation. So we're one step away, two steps away from the original. Another important development is the arrival in the 1470s of the printing press to England. William Caxton brings the press to England. And you'll see in the handout that Caxton printed a work called The Golden Legend in 1483, which is the first printed book to contain translations into English of the Bible. So this happens even before Tyndale. Another very important event is the creation of the Gutenberg Bible. The Gutenberg Bible is not the first printed book. It's just the first significant printed book. There are 30 or so copies of the Gutenberg Bible surviving in various libraries around the world. And the important thing about the Gutenberg Bible is that it is both a printed book and a manuscript. So all the black that you see there is print. It's been printed with movable type. There are two versions of the Gutenberg Bible, one in vellum, so leather, and the other in paper. And the vellum Bible is printed in two volumes because vellum is a lot thicker. And all the color that you see there, All the illumination is done by hand. So that makes it a manuscript as well as a book. And one of the reasons why this is done is that there was a lot of skepticism when the book was, the printed book was introduced in the 1440s by Gutenberg. People said if it's not handwritten, it's not really a book. So it's sort of like e-books today. A lot of people don't accept e-books as real books because they're not made out of paper, etc. So in order to kind of overcome that prejudice, early books were meant to, were made to look like manuscript books, as if they'd been produced in scriptoria. So this is true of the Gutenberg Bible. But indeed, it is also a manuscript, as I said. And the other thing that is important to note about that is that no two copies of the Gutenberg Bible are the same, because all the illumination is unique. So here we see various editions of various copies of the Gutenberg Bible with different illumination. And you can imagine that the illumination would have taken a lot of time. It's a lot of care that went into to that. So these are from all over the world. Now, this is a picture of a page from a Bible that we have at the front. This is what is known as the Glossa Ordinaria. So what you see in that little square in the middle is from the book of Isaiah. The text around the outside is the gloss or the commentary. And what tended to happen is this commentary, which was written by church fathers and medieval scholars like Nicholas of Lyra, it tended to fix the meaning of the text. And it's interesting, when Martin Luther, in the early stages of his Reformation, was beginning a lecture series on the book of Psalms, he asked his printer to print a Psalter with blank wide margins, without the Glossa Ordinaria, without this gloss, because he wanted his students to make their own notes. It's the first wide margin Bible, 1513. So this also, and you can see this example, this Bible leaf at the front, is both a printed book and a manuscript. So again, all the black is printed, and the color, which you see there, little paraff marks and the capitals in blue and red, those are all done by hand. So it is very much partially a medieval manuscript. And that page, by the way, is from 1480, and I bring it in to the classroom when I'm teaching the history of the printing press, and I tell the students I'm going to show them something that's older than me. It is over 500 years old. This is a fully printed edition of the Vulgate from Isaiah 61. Spiritus Domini super me, the Spirit of the Lord is upon me, etc. Quoted, of course, in the New Testament. There you can see it a little bit bigger. Yeah, there it is there. So this is that was a very small edition of the Vulgate. And again, most of these leaves you'll see at the front here. Here's another one that has a hand illuminated capital. This is a polyglot. So this Bible right here, which is the Complutensian polyglot, has a number of different languages. It was printed in 1514, but it wasn't published until 1521, 1522. So this means that Erasmus actually has claim to the first published polyglot. But you can see various languages there. Aramaic, there's Latin, there's Greek, and there's Hebrew, and all kinds of notes as well. This is very useful for Bible scholarship, but also translation. So Erasmus is involved in doing this as well. He's a humanist, by which I mean a Renaissance humanist, so he's a textual scholar. And he produces an edition of the New Testament, a Greek edition of the New Testament, with a new Latin translation, not the Vulgate. And this is the basis for Luther's New Testament in German and Tyndale's New Testament in English. And there you can see the opening of Romans. So there's the original Greek, and there is his translation, fresh translation in Latin, which would help translators. Now the Bible is going to be translated from the original language. So it's a translation, not a translation of a translation. And here we see Erasmus's philosophy. I wish that the humblest might read the Gospels and the Epistles of Paul. I wish that they might be translated into all tongues of all people so that not only the Scots and the Irish, but also the Turk and the Saracen, he's thinking of people who are sort of on the outskirts of Europe, might read and understand. I would that the countryman might sing some parts of them at the plow, the weaver chant them at his loom, the traveler lighten them with the weariness of his journey. This is a slightly later edition of the Greek New Testament. This is the edition produced by Stephanus, and it is the basis for the King James New Testament. Now, this was the best that scholarship could produce in the day, and this is what the King James is based on. There's some debate about this. In my own view, the texts that we have today are better in most cases. So this is one deficiency of the King James, is that it's not based on the best text. But it should be pointed out that variants that have a significant impact are actually very, very few. Most of the variants are not translatable. In other words, they're just spelling differences. So you can't even translate them. That's how insignificant they are. But this one is a particularly interesting example. This is from 1 John 5. And the so-called Coma Johannaeum, the three heavenly witnesses passage, 1 John 5 and 7, is in this text and it makes it into the King James. We now know that it's an interpolation. It's meant to bolster the doctrine of the Trinity, which otherwise is not in the New Testament. So, again, there's some problems with some of these early texts, but they were doing the best. It was the best they could do based on the evidence at the time. This is Martin Luther. And this is his German New Testament. And he writes in a very vivid German, and he actually helps unify the German language in producing this. Not everyone is literate. The production of the Bible in the vernacular does help create literacy, but there's still a need to reach people who are not literate. And so these kinds of engravings are produced, and they're almost like cartoons. And what you see here is an image that is divided into two. So on the right, you have the Catholics, and the Catholic priest up there is saying, "Sic dicit Papa, thus says the Pope," and you can see that he's tonsured, and there's a woman with rosary beads. On this side, you have the Lutheran, the evangelical, who's saying, "Thus says the Lord concerning," and he's preaching from the Bible, not on the authority of the Pope. And notice here that the woman has a Bible. She has a personal Bible, so this is what the Reformation does. Notice also that there is a little hourglass beside the Catholic preacher. And that is meant, this is produced, by the way, by Lutherans. That is meant to mock the shortness of the Catholic sermons, which were, you know, could be measured in minutes, whereas a good Lutheran sermon could be measured in hours. But this was meant, again, to reach illiterates. Martin Luther pronounced the idea of sola scriptura, that a doctrine be based on the Bible. He doesn't adhere to it perfectly himself. But one thing that we've seen in the history of science is an argument produced by a fellow named Peter Harrison, who was at a conference I attended in Vancouver just a few days ago. And this is the idea that the Protestant argument that we should develop or create or take our doctrine straight from the Bible without using authorities actually helps influence the scientific revolution. So early natural philosophers who are studying nature now begin to go directly to nature rather than relying on the authority of Aristotle, Ptolemy, etc. So that's another way in which the Bible has had an influence. We now reach William Tyndale. And there you see Tyndale, a painting that is now today in Oxford. And you can see there's a little epigram at the bottom right there. And it can be translated in the following way. "To scatter Roman darkness by this light, the loss of land and life I'll reckon slight." So Roman darkness would be Catholic teaching. Tyndale followed in the footsteps of Erasmus and was a strong believer in vernacular translation. This is what he said. You can see the echo of Erasmus's own argument here. Master Tyndale happened to be in the company of a learned man, and in communing and disputing with him, drove him to that issue that the learned man said, we were better be without God's laws and the Pope's. Master Tyndall, hearing that, answered him, I defy the Pope and all his laws, and said, if God spare my life, ere many years I will cause a boy that driveth the plow shall know more of the scripture than thou dost. And that hope came to pass. So this is one of Tyndall's first New Testaments. This is the Gospel of John. Here's a slightly later edition of his New Testament. And you can see that it's in black letter. One of his opponents was Sir Thomas More, and they had a big debate over translating particular terms. So More wanted the word elder translated as priest, and he also wanted the word ecclesia translated as church. We've already mentioned this. And Tyndall said, no, it should be translated as congregation. Tyndall's influence is seen in this this chart right here, which shows that 84% of the New Testament wording comes from Tyndall in the King James, and 76% of the King James is Tyndall. That is to say, those parts of the Bible, the Old Testament that Tyndall translated that came through to the King James, 76% of those are Tyndall. So when we talk about the King James Bible, we're talking about a Bible that effectively is, in many cases, 500 years old. Okay, we'll move on and talk a little bit more about some later English editions. This is a stained glass window showing Tyndall. This is from Oxford. So, King Henry VIII broke with Rome because he wanted a divorce, etc. There's some political reasons. And this is one of the important chapters in Bible translation in the 16th century. So when Tyndall was burnt at the stake, he was strangled and then burnt at the stake, he said, Lord, open the King of England's eyes. In fact, by this time, Henry VIII's eyes had been opened in a certain sense, and a series of Bibles were produced in England in the latter years of his reign. And so here we see the title page of the Coverdale Bible and some pictures from the Coverdale Bible, from actually the Coverdale Bible that's owned by this ecclesia. And we're moving on to see a later edition of the Coverdale Bible here. This is from the Book of Psalms. See some of the detail there. This is the Great Bible, 1539. You can see an image from the Great Bible there, from the 1569 edition. This is the Book of Genesis. It's all in black letter. King Henry VIII, King Edward VI, the son of King Henry VIII, didn't live very long. There were 50 Bibles produced during King Edward VI's reign, and England, by the way, was never more Protestant than it was during King Edward VI's reign. Then we have Queen Mary, otherwise known as Bloody Mary, who came to the throne, and a number of Puritans or Calvinists leave England, and they produce the Geneva Bible in Geneva. So here we see some images from the Geneva Bible. The Geneva Bible has a commentary around it, and that's significant. But it's a very clear translation. They also use Roman letter rather than black letter, so it's easy to read. And they introduce verses throughout the Bible. And this is from Isaiah. Queen Elizabeth I, under her reign, we see the Bishop's Bible. And there you see Elizabeth on the front page of the Bishop's Bible. This is from the Book of Matthew, the Bishop's Bible. So again, black letter. The Bishop's Bible is actually a little bit bigger than the King James. So if you can imagine, bigger than that book that you see there. This is a leaf that we have at the front. And you can see that the B there is hand colored. So this was common even as late as 1560s when the Bishop's Bible was produced. Here's an engraving from the beginning of the Book of Psalms. From the Bishop's Bible, and it shows the statesman William Cecil, Lord Burleigh, who was then Secretary of State, and Elizabeth's leading advisor, who plays a small role in bringing this Bible out. The Catholic exiles in France, the Catholic, English Catholics, produced their own translation, the first the New Testament and then the Old Testament, and here you see some copies of that. This is James the First of England, and it is under his during his reign that we see the Hampton Court Conference, 1604, and the decision to produce a new Bible. Not a completely new translation. It's going to be a revision. They decide to revise the Bishop's Bible. And this is a political move, because what he wants to do is he wants to bring together the High Church faction and the Calvinists. The Calvinists are more radical. Their beliefs are a little bit closer to biblical beliefs. The High Church have more of a focus on ritual and that sort of thing. So what they end up producing is a kind of a compromise. It's a Bible that pleased both the Puritans mostly and the Anglicans. Although there are still Anglicanisms in the text, including the word bishop, for example, which is not a very good translation. It's quite misleading. So here's the title page. You've already seen it. The dedication to James the First, and there's an interesting reference here to finding a kind of middle path between popery and radical Puritanism. This is the English church's way, the Anglican way, to try to find this kind of middle ground, which doesn't please everyone, of course. There you see the reference there. And the translator's introduction by John Smith, I think his name was, and they provide an introduction to the translation philosophy, and there's also a little history of the translations of the Bible. There is, and this is a somewhat comical, there is a kind of a conspiracy theory, which I don't adhere to, by the way, that the language of the King James Bible is so good, it must have been written by Shakespeare. So if you go to Psalm 46, and you count from the beginning 46 words, you get Shake, from the end you get Spear, Shakespeare, and this is Shakespeare's signature. This is a very old kind of joke, but I don't think we should take any stock in it. So this is the first page of the King James translation, the book of Genesis. So you can see it's black letter. There's some marginal notes, but no commentary. Those are only textual notes. And there are some headings. And also, when words are not found in the original, they're put into Roman type. King James translations render those in italics. You can see the fancy capital there. This is from Matthew. So you can see some examples. We have some actual leaves. We've got three leaves from the original King James Bible at the front, so you get a sense of the size, etc. There are two versions of the first folio edition of the King James called the He and She Bibles, and this is just based on the variant here in Ruth chapter 3 and verse 15. There are some other differences. What this shows is that it was very hard to maintain a standard text, because it's very easy to introduce errors, the copyists, many of whom were only semi-literate. This is the title page to the New Testament of the King James. And then there's a quarto that's produced in 1612, which has Roman text. This is a little easier to read. It's a little smaller, smaller format, a little less expensive. And this one here is the 72-line folio edition. So the original King James is in 59 lines, the facsimile of which we have here. This one is produced with a smaller font, so it's 72 lines, 200 pages less. So it was actually cheaper, it was a bit lighter, but it still was a pulpit Bible. It still had the look of a pulpit Bible, and that was produced in 1613. This is the elephant folio, and all of these you'll see at the front here. These are just scans of leaves that we have at the front. This is a very large folio. Okay, now, I need to wrap up, so I want to just say a little bit about Bible translation and then we will conclude. It's a little bit out of order. This is one of the grandest editions of the King James, the Baskerville King James, published in the 18th century. So we see how the art of printing had advanced by that time. Okay, so just a couple things about translation. The King James is a formal correspondence translation. Let's say it's word for word. Not woodenly literal, but tending towards a literal. Dynamic equivalence is thought for thought. Problem with dynamic equivalence, it often makes for nice reading, but there's a lot of subjectivity there. So often what you get is an interpretation rather than a translation. And the same problem applies to paraphrase as well. Some of the pitfalls of dynamic equivalence and paraphrase, you see a flattening of meaning, loss of original metaphors. You want the original metaphors. You don't want someone else's metaphors. You want the biblical metaphors if you want to study the Bible. You see the introduction of interpretation, the use sometimes of anachronistic language. Often literary excellence is sacrificed, and often the aim is at the lowest common denominator. So translators of these Bibles often proudly announce that they're written at a grade 5 or grade 6 level, whereas the King James is written at about a grade 11 level. And so is the ESV, which is, I think, probably the best translation on the market today. And they veer too far from the Tyndale KJV wording, and this affects recall, right? We get this kind of babel where there's so many different wordings that we can't remember the text. I'll just skip over this. I want to give you a couple of examples. What the King James Bible does is it sets a standard for a literal and literary translation. So it's very well written, but it's also literal. It is close to the original. And this is what the translators wanted. They said it's like opening a window, opening a window onto the original language. You want to see the Miles Smith, that's the name of the fellow who wrote the translators to the reader. Okay, so just a few examples of some comparisons. The King James translation of Psalm 1, verse 1, probably most of you know it quite well. It's exactly the same as in the Bishop's Bible. And we see all these units of thought in the original Greek, the original Hebrew. They come through in the English. So let's just compare this with other translations. You see the Living Bible, a lot of the meaning is lost. The NIV is pretty good. It's basically all there. The CEV, most of it is gone. The ESV, also, everything is there. In fact, the wording is very, very similar. And there's a progression here. When you read it in the original, there's a progression that you don't want to lose. The Holman Christian Standard Bible, the information is there, but some of it's in footnotes rather than the text. So why not just put it in the text? So that's a little bit complicated. The CEB, some of it is lost as well. The Latin Vulgate is actually very good. All the meaning is there. Walking, standing, sitting, everything is there. Now, this is what I think is an excellent example of the literary value of the King James. Proverbs 3 and verse 7, this has come straight into hymns. Her ways are ways of pleasantness, and all her paths are peace. This actually scans very well. If you look at this as poetry, there's three iambic feet followed by two unstressed syllables followed by three iambic feet, and you can actually hear the last word of the first line cascading downwards. Her ways are ways of pleasantness, and all her paths are peace. And the translation picks up on the duplication of ways in the Hebrew there. You can also see that the original has a bit of rhyme at the end. These are some examples of earlier translations. The Bishop's Bible is the same. And some other translations just don't quite cut it. Wisdom can make your life pleasant and lead you safely through it. Wisdom makes life pleasant and leads us safely along. Doesn't quite have the same ring. Her ways are pleasant ways and all her paths peaceful. That one kind of falls flat as well. Her ways are pleasant ways and all her paths are peace. Her ways are filled with delight. Her paths lead to contentment. That's the Jerusalem Bible. The NIV, her ways are pleasant ways and all her paths are peace. NASV, her ways are pleasant ways and all her paths are peace. So there's some different ones there too. Her ways are pleasant and all her paths peaceful. They don't quite rise to the standard of the King James. But notice this, the RV, the ASV, the RSV, the New King James, and the ESV from 2001 take the King James wording verbatim and bring it into their translation. So there's actually a lot of that, a lot of the King James in the ESV word for word. So this is the Michael Bruce hymn, which has those lines straight from the King James because they scan so well. Literalness in translation is also very important. The King James translation of Philippians 2, 5, and 6. This is obviously a text that has doctrinal import. The ESV, a very good translation. Have this mind among yourselves, which is yours in Christ Jesus, who, though he was in the form of God, did not account equality with God a thing to be grasped. That, I can tell you, is exactly what the Greek is saying. Compare that with the Living Translation. Your attitude should be the kind that was shown to us by Jesus Christ, who, though he was God, did not demand and cling to his rights as God. The Greek doesn't say that. So what we have here is someone's interpretation masquerading as a translation. Have this attitude in yourselves, which is also in Christ Jesus, who, though he existed in the form of God, doesn't say that either. That's the NASB. Your attitude should be the same as that of Christ Jesus, who, being in very nature God, and then the original Greek is in the footnote, the form of. So why not just put form there? Form is a term that is monosyllabic. It's a very simple form. Everyone should understand that. When you say very nature, you're talking about substance, and this text does not talk about that. And the other thing is that you lose the allusion, which is to Adam. Adam and Eve grasping at equality with God. You completely lose that, and you get this kind of Trinitarian interpolation, which is quite unfortunate. Here's another example of that. So the King James sets a standard for accuracy that I think is commendable, and the formal correspondence translations do maintain that. Here's another example where we see the King James language continuing in later translations, the RV, the RSV. So there are many examples of this where you see language which is 400 to 500 years old being used in modern translations as well. So we've come a long way, and we're a little bit over time, but that gives you a sense of some of the issues. We've looked at some of the history, but also the standards set by the King James. I'm not a King James-only person myself. I think there are some problems with the King James. Some of the language is archaic, and it's becoming more and more archaic. There are some problems with some of the texts. They're not as accurate as the ones we have today. But in general, the literary excellence and the standard translation is a good one. And this is what we want if what we want is to study the Word of God. Thank you.